This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A new University of Colorado analysis has found that concerns about concussions and other controversies surrounding the National Football League will lead to a further decline in the number of high schoolers playing football. The study found that the number of high schoolers playing football grew steadily from 1998 to 2009, but has since been in a notable decline, and that is likely to continue. What do parents, players, and coaches need to know about concussions and brain injuries? Can football and other youth sports be played in a way that maintains the spirit of the games and prevents or reduces the number of concussions and other injuries? Do you play football? Did you play football and now you wonder about your brain health? Or do you wonder, what's all this fuss about? Are you a parent? Do you encourage your child to play football? Or did you tell them to pick another sport? Call in. The number to call is 210-614-8980. We really want to hear from you on this, 210-614-8980. And you can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this afternoon, we're joined by Jamie Harrison. He is the Deputy Director of the University Interscholastic League, known as the UIL, which is the governing body of sports in high schools in Texas. Dr. Dan Santamaria is a physician at the Sports Medicine San Antonio. And Dr. Monroe Cullum, he is a neuropsychologist with the O'Donnell Brain Institute at UT Southwestern, oversees the Texas Sports Concussion Registry. And welcome, all of you. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Dan Santamaria, what happens to the brain when someone says they have a concussion?
Well, therein things get a little controversial. So one thing we see consistently with a concussion injury is normally your neuroimaging, even a high-level MRI, is going to be normal. But they do think there's a cascade of metabolic dysfunctions that happen at the level of a neuron, where the neuron's ability to function, its ability to metabolize and regulate the electrolytes flowing in and out of it, is altered. So I tell folks, although the ramifications can be more serious, you can almost think of it like a muscle cramp of the brain. But unlike a muscle cramp of the legs, there's just more time needed for that sensitive, delicate environment of the brain to reset, recalibrate itself, and allow for healing and return to sports.
So is the concussion caused by the blow to the head, or is it caused by the brain, which is floating in fluid inside the head, crashing up against the inside of the skull?
It could be both. And that's what makes preventing concussions, makes it such a difficult thing to target. Both direct blows to the head and certainly this acceleration, deceleration, rotational forces, a strong enough blow to the body, a blow to the jaw, certainly. We see that a lot with boxing, right? If somebody just takes a hit at the right spot of the jaw, sets up a process where the head and neck whips back and the brain within the confines of the skull jostles around and the skull designed to protect the brain can actually be a source of direct injury.
Dr. Monroe Cullum, tell me about the Texas Sports Concussion Registry.
Yes, that's an exciting collaboration between UT Southwestern Medical Center and the O'Donnell Brain Institute and the UIL. We have Mr. Jamie Harrison on the line today, too. Our interest is to begin to get a handle on how many concussions are actually occurring across the state of Texas, because right now we don't know. The CDC has estimates based on emergency room visits and other reports, but a lot of concussions do not show up in emergency rooms. And before we can be able to help identify regions that are utilizing best practices or changes in rules and equipment and to look at the effect of those things on rates of concussions, we need to get a baseline to see how many concussions are actually occurring. And this is a first major step in that direction.
How do we distinguish, Dr. Cullum, from a concussion and a brain injury?
Well, a concussion is a brain injury, so those are one and the same. The terms are often used interchangeably, mild brain injury or concussion. As was just noted, it's a temporary disruption in normal, you know, cognitive and brain function. But a concussion is actually a brain injury.
So Jamie Harrison at the UIL, talk about the stance that the UIL has taken in trying to deal with concerns about concussions.
Well, we've tried to address those concerns from a number of different fronts. First, we were the first state association to implement full contact limitations in football. When we did that a few years ago, we have a number of education components, training coaches and trainers on recognizing concussions, identifying concussions, responding to concussions. There are provisions in place for return-to-play protocols when a player is suspected of having sustained a concussion. So we've covered all of those fronts, and then also, you know, working with UT Southwestern and the Brain Institute to conduct research is really a dramatic step forward for a state association like UIL, where we're very clear from the beginning, and the folks at UT Southwestern agreed, unlike some other leagues, maybe even professional leagues, that have come under some scrutiny for conducting their own research and then reporting out on that, we're not conducting the research. We reached out to a true medical research center to conduct that research for us. The agreement between us is very clear. UIL doesn't touch the data or manipulate the data in any way. The medical researchers do that and then provide their analysis back to the UIL to help inform policy decisions moving forward related to keeping our kids as safe as we can possibly keep them in all of our activities.
Playing football has changed a lot since the dark ages when I played high school football. It's amazing all of the regulations are in place in order to protect the kids, particularly limiting the amount of practice, time on the field. Can you talk about that, Jamie Harrison, about why that's so important?
Well, we limit time on the field for a number of reasons. Heat-related illness is certainly a big part of that, but we also, not just time on the field, but specific to full contact is where we limited that. For obvious reasons. If you have less contact, one would hope you're going to have less concussions. While that's a good common sense approach to take, we need some research to then support that. So that's why having this agreement with UT Southwestern and this collaboration for them to conduct the research on the number of cases of suspected concussions is so important to us. But, you know, we're also looking at further education. We have a rule change proposal coming up here in a couple of weeks to be promulgated, working really closely with the Texas High School Coaches Association that would require all football coaches in the state of Texas to undergo training and teaching the best practices for teaching tackling.
Is that heads-up football?
It's not heads-up football. It's a different approach. It's got a lot of the same components as heads-up football. Heads-up football is specifically a program offered by USA Football. This is a program more associated with what many people know as hawk tackling, because it's tied to Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks. But they actually got it from a group called Atavis in Washington, and the folks at the Coaches Association have recently visited with them about the training techniques and are really excited about putting this requirement in for all UIL football coaches.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll hear more about the proposed rule changes to the UIL, which is the governing body for public high school sports in Texas. And we've got some callers. We'll get them on the air. The number for you to call in to join the conversation as we talk about brain injury in youth sports, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about concussions and sports, youth sports. You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Brandy is on the line. And Brandy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I'm a parent of two toddlers, and one is a boy, and so I do think about this. I have him in soccer, actually, but I would definitely not encourage my children to play football or do boxing, any of those sports that could put them at risk for traumatic brain injury. And I just wanted to call in because I recently watched a really interesting documentary on PBS on Frontline, and where they talked about the NFL hiding this information for a long period of time because they had done autopsies on some of the Pittsburgh Steelers that had committed suicide, and their brains, when they looked at them at a young age, had such damage to them that you would see something like that in a 70-year-old. So I just wanted to know what your guess, if they comment on that.
Brandy, thank you for the call, and I think you are vocalizing what a lot of people are thinking. They saw that same Frontline documentary. Dr. Monroe Cullum, neuropsychologist at the O'Donnell Brain Institute at UT Southwestern, can you react to that?
I'm very happy to. So you're referring to the condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. First of all, we don't know how many people actually get CTE. We actually don't know the causes of CTE at this point in time. The brains that have been studied to date from the largely suicide completers is a sample of brains that have been very carefully selected and sent for analysis to one lab. So we really don't know how prevalent it is, and we also don't understand what all the risk factors are for CTE. We do know that not everybody that gets a concussion is going to get CTE, because most people don't get it. The number one cause of concussions in people under age 20 is falling off of bicycles, according to the CDC. So football is not even the number one cause of concussions in children. But there's a lot that we need to learn about CTE. What we need are large-scale studies of a variety of athletes who have sustained concussions and those who haven't sustained concussions, and study their brains in a large fashion in order to really begin to understand what causes this condition and how prevalent it is, because right now we do not know.
All right, let's go to Luis on the line. Luis, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
Good, good. I was calling because I remember when I played high school football out in West Texas back in the mid-90s, my friend and I collided, and he ended up going to the hospital. He had a full-on concussion, and I suffered a mild concussion, but I was okay, and I remember his symptoms were real severe. But anyways, point being, I had to take the SAT the next day. And needless to say, I had to take it again because that first go-around was just, I mean, I don't even know why I showed up other than that I, you know, my parents paid for the test. But, it was difficult, at least.
Luis, thank you for the call. So Dr. Santa Maria, Dan Santa Maria at the Sports Medicine San Antonio, why did Luis have trouble with the SAT the day after he got his bell rung?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly many cases of concussion, the abilities to focus, to concentrate, one's ability to be aware of their environmental surroundings, and then focus and recall the information that they may well have stored in their data banks for a test can be impaired. And these symptoms can even stick around, affecting not only one's ability to perform well academically, but also from a muscular control and speed and agility and awareness of one's body position affect their ability to play safely even after their symptoms of headaches resolve or when those symptoms are very minimal. So it's another aspect of concussions that I think we have to be attuned to. And certainly with our college athletes and all the high school athletes that we see in our practice, we'll often send them unless they are nearly completely asymptomatic. And oftentimes even in those cases with academic accommodations to protect, to support them, especially in case they have a major life or career changing test that's coming up very soon.
If you're a parent and you're the child of someone who went through that, what should you do that, you know, to help them heal?
Mm. Well, the key principles of concussion recovery still include time, rest, and natural healing. In the acute window, it certainly is appropriate to monitor for worsening of symptoms, especially in the first few days after a concussion. Severe headaches. The young athlete or child becomes lethargic and just as unresponsive. But nowadays, the best practice is not to wake them up repeatedly overnight, much like if they were in the ICU or the hospital, because the vast majority of children do well with sleep and need sleep to recover. Minimizing distractive sources in their environment, including excessive texting, social media, video games, especially for the boys. And of course, if they're of a driving age, I tell all my athletes they're unsafe to drive until they are fully back to their sports and performing at their maximum capacity, because we don't want them to have a more serious injury if they get behind the wheel.
So they should stay away from screens after a head injury like that?
Yes, absolutely. Now, it may be unrealistic to tell a kid don't text, but I say you just want to pull yourself off of social media. And certainly the positive behaviors we want to encourage in a young individual, reading for recreation or for extra credit work, that also we have to minimize. Excessively strenuous housework or work on a job that they may be holding as well, all of these things are brought down to a minimum. And if they're extremely symptomatic, we want to hold them from school, but then get them back in a timely fashion with protective accommodations so that they don't fall too far behind, and that becomes an additional stressor as they recover.
Jamie Harrison at the UIL, can you talk about how, doctors have a role to play in making sure that these players come back to the field at the right time?
Well, we have rules at the UIL, and there's also a state law that requires any time a kid is suspected to have suffered a concussion, and that's an important distinction. That is absent an actual diagnosis of concussion, but if they are suspected of having had a concussion, they have to be cleared by a medical professional, and they have to complete the school's return-to-play protocol. Having an appropriate return-to-play protocol, we think, is critical. That is one that would, very similar to what the other two guests have shared, would bring the student back to play gradually and slowly, starting with, minimal exertion indoors and whatever that particular return-to-play protocol includes, but a very gradual and slow return to full inclusion in the activity.
Let's go to the caller. This is Maria. Maria, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. We have been speaking about concussions, and mostly in the context of football. I know football is king in Texas, but there's other sports that are also prone to cause student-athletes to have concussions. I have a daughter who plays high school soccer, and she had a mild concussion earlier at the beginning of the season last year. And my question is for the representative of the UIL. She was speaking about sending the coaches, the football coaches, to special training about tackling and all these great resources that the UIL and the state have available for coaches, football coaches, to identify and prevent concussions in the student athletes. My question is, are we including all other coaches, your wrestling coaches, your soccer coaches, other sports that also may have a possibility of creating or giving a kid a concussion, right? Are they also going to be included in this training? What other things are out there that are not necessarily just for football players, but for all the kiddos that go to the school,
okay,
that play a sport?
We got the question, Maria. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Jamie Harrison from the UIL.
Great question, and I apologize if any of my prior comments were misunderstood. You're right. Soccer is a sport that certainly has a high rate of concussion. It was interesting that a previous caller said she had two children, both in soccer, but wouldn't let them play football. And soccer is the second leading, has the second highest rate of concussions amongst high school sports for boys, and the highest amongst high school sports for girls. So soccer definitely is a sport that we focus on. So all of those training requirements that I spoke of, those are required of every single UIL coach in every UIL sport. The only thing different for football, and it's not even different yet, it's a rule change proposal that is about to be considered by our rulemaking body, the UIL Legislative Council, is about teaching safe tackling. But everything else about identifying concussions and treating concussions and how to help students recover from concussions, all of those requirements are for all sports, all coaches, all levels, 7th grade through 12th grade, every single sport we have.
The law that went into effect tries to reduce concussions in high school football, high school sports, is Jessica's Law, named for a young woman who was dealing with those concussions. Jamie Harrison?
Yes, absolutely. And we may have two laws. I know of Natasha's Law, Natasha was definitely a soccer player, and mm-hmm. that's why the law is named after her. She had suffered repeated concussions, and that law has been great in the state of Texas. It was largely what UIL had in place by rule. What it did was allow more flexibility for school districts in determining their own return to play protocol, but also helped give all of those requirements the force of law, which is UIL rule is definitely important, but it doesn't carry the weight of the force of law. Representative Ford Price from the Amarillo area sponsored that bill and did a great job of championing it all the way into law.
And Dr. Monroe Cullum, do you see soccer players and other players come through with these concussions?
Absolutely. And as Mr. Harrison noted, we see a lot of concussions in female athletes, and it's very, very important to us to study these concussions, especially in young females, because we actually don't know as much about the risk factors and recovery patterns in young female athletes as we do males. If you look at the concussion statistics, for example, in soccer, it appears that young women may be actually more vulnerable than their male counterparts to concussions, and we don't fully understand that, but maybe related to neck musculature as well as different hormonal issues and whatnot. But these are very, very important things for us to learn more about, and it's actually surprising how relatively little we know about what all the risk factors are for prolonged recovery. So that's one of the goals of our research here at UT Southwestern.
And how do the head injuries happen while playing soccer? Is that from headbutting the ball or just in the playing just a robust game of soccer, Dr. Cullum?
Well, it's often head-to-ground contact, head-to-head contact, kids going up for headers at the same time. It's typically not the head-to-ball. If an athlete is braced appropriately for doing a header, there's typically not a concussive effect in most of the situations, unless a ball comes at high velocity, you know, from a blind side or you know, the side and the player's not expecting it. That can certainly result in some concussion symptoms. But it's, kids running into the goalpost, each other, body checking sometimes, hits to the body and torso, shaking the head, and then the head perhaps coming in contact with the ground as well. So there's a variety of mechanisms within soccer.
It seems like kids playing are going to get a concussion. The question is, will that concussion will be identified, and how do we prevent a secondary concussion, which will actually create much more brain injury than just one single concussion? Is that right, Dr. Santa Maria?
Yes, and certainly this is one of the areas of controversy and vagaries. If somebody's had three concussions, if they've had four, if they've had five, they've had six. At what point do we decide just to hold an athlete from sports?
And then the idea is to try and make sure that we can play sports, but play them safely.
Absolutely.
And so we're trying to get to that point. And so we're going to talk more about that when we come back from this break. If you're a parent, if you're encouraging your child to play football or other sports, how are you going to keep an eye out for a head injury, concussion? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Or do you wonder about what's the future of play in sports and these other items that we have? Are concussions a clear and present danger to these sports? 210-614-8980. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. What are the risks for brain injury in youth sports? And youth sports is a big umbrella. We've got tykes playing tackle football, as well as kids in high school who are being supervised, and kids in college are all playing football and other sports that could involve brain injury. If you've got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. And Josh is on the line. Josh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have a question which is a little bit different than kids. My father recently had a concussion, and the reason I bring it up is because we have kind of family history of dementia. And so my question is there any link between severity or number of concussions and future signs of dementia?
Thank you for that call. Dr. Monroe Cullum.
That is a big question of the day right now. We know that most people that suffer concussions do recover completely, and there do not appear to be later life risks. However, that said, there is mounting evidence to suggest that certainly a concussion or brain injury with loss of consciousness, if someone does develop a dementia later in life, they may get it a little bit earlier, a couple of years earlier than if they didn't have that brain injury earlier in life. And we're just beginning to start to understand some of the potential mechanisms that may be related to this potential link that we see. In individual cases, though, it's really difficult to tell. And there's a lot that science doesn't yet understand about this possible link. There may be a variety of pathological factors that an early injury sets up later in life, but uncomplicated concussions for most people do not seem to be a major risk for dementia later in life. But if you look at group studies, there are trends that go in that direction. So right now we also don't know really in an individual case who's at most risk. It doesn't seem to matter as much in terms of the number of concussions, unless it seems to be more related to the severity and loss of consciousness, perhaps being a key to that, with longer loss of consciousness associated with greater risk.
And Dr. Cullum, our caller brings up his family has a trend in one way or another, and that brings up genetic variation. It seems like some people can take a lot of hits to the head and not get severe concussions. They must be part woodpecker or something, and other people are vulnerable to concussions. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And another thing that we're working on understanding better, you'll see some of our great commentators from NFL glory days that are completely intact despite a number of concussions. No two concussions are alike, and the vulnerability to concussion is not well understood. So if you or I sustain the same exact impact to our brains today, your symptoms tomorrow might be gone. I might be still experiencing dizziness or some foggy thinking. And there probably are some genetic as well as physical factors that relate to our different vulnerabilities to the effects of concussion.
Another caller, and this is from Aaron. Aaron, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm not as familiar with the contact sports. I've had daughters that played other sports like track and whatnot. And I was just kind of curious, what are the benefits of these sports, these contact or high-risk sports, as opposed to the risks to our children? How are we justifying, wow, it has this benefit, and it's so big that we will put our children at risk for brain injury.
All right, Aaron, thank you for the call. Let me go to Jamie Harrison about that. He's the deputy director for the University Interscholastic League, and the UIL has a mission in order to provide a healthy competition in athletics and also in band and math and all these other things. So can you talk about that?
I can, and it's a great question. So generally, there is a ton of research that documents the overwhelming benefits of participation in extracurricular activities as a whole, and certainly in athletics as well. From reduced dropout rates to reduced discipline problems, increased academic performance, increased attendance, I could go on and on. There are studies that talk about post-high school success that is directly correlated to extracurricular participation. So participating in these activities has a world of life lessons that come with them. And again, football gets the focus, but football is certainly not the only concussion-related activity. Anytime you have two kids competing in each other and they're moving around, you're at risk of concussion. So to eliminate the risk of concussion, you're going to have to eliminate sports altogether. Even in track and field, where you would think there's very limited risk of concussion, there are accidents that happen in the field events. There are hurdle events where students can impact the ground or each other. Interestingly enough, the second highest rate of concussions amongst high school-aged girls nationally is cheerleading. So to reduce, to eliminate the risk of concussion in sports is to eliminate sports, by and large. And I think that the benefits of participating in sports far outweigh the risks. That said, that doesn't mean that we don't have to continue to try to make these activities safer. I happen to be the father of two sons. My oldest son actually tonight will compete in a seventh grade football game, and my younger son competes in youth football, and I'm very comfortable with that. I'm involved in coaching the youth football team, so we make sure we do it in a safe possible way. So the way you practice, the way you teach tackling in football, the way you practice in all sports, and the more coaches understand concussions and how to reduce the risk of them, the safer we can make our activities. But to eliminate those risks altogether means that you'll never put your child on a bicycle. As Dr. Cullen mentioned earlier, that's actually the number one cause of concussions. So you'll never put your child on a bicycle. You'll never put your child on a skateboard. You'll never put your child in a basketball uniform or a volleyball uniform or have your student, your child jump over a hurdle. And both the physical, the social, and the academic benefits of participating in those activities, in my opinion, far outweigh the risks, as long as competing in those and practicing for those are done in a responsible, safe manner.
And a bike helmet will not prevent a concussion if you fall off the bike. It'll just prevent cracking your skull. It won't preserve your brain. Is that right, Dr. Santa Maria?
Absolutely. It's that same mechanism that you alluded to, the rotational acceleration, deceleration, and the brain jostling around within the confines of the skull. Now, that said, the helmets do have a true protective effect in football and in other sports of preventing serious brain injuries, including bleeding within the skull, known as an intracranial hemorrhage. But it does not prevent any injury, and certainly not every concussion.
So, Jamie Harrison at UIL, what can be done? What are some of the rule changes that y'all are looking at that could make football just a little bit safer? The caller, Aaron, referred to the risk, so we have to identify the risk. Other states have seen that a lot of concussions playing football come from open field tackles, and they have moved the ball forward on the field to sort of reduce the momentum and the speed involved in the kickoff. Is that something that Texas has looked at or will look at?
We have had that discussion and an ongoing discussion for some time. At UIL, we compete by NCAA football playing rules with a number of exceptions to them. And so being aligned with the national organization, with the resources that the NCAA brings to bear in terms of medical science is certainly a great thing. We have our own UIL Medical Advisory Committee that involves specialists from multiple different medical fields. In fact, one of Dr. Cullum's colleagues at the Brain Institute, I believe he co-runs the Brain Institute, is Dr. Hunt Bajer, who co-chairs the NFL's Head and Neck Committee, serves as an ex officio member and advisor to the UIL Medical Advisory Committee. So making sure that we have the right medical scientists and doctors involved in helping inform those policy decisions moving forward is critical. Having limitations on contact in practice and in spring training, for example, having the right acclimatization periods before you can have any contact are all very important. We feel like we are absolutely on the cutting edge when it comes to high school associations in the country with providing those limitations and in the safest practices. But at the same time, we're not resting on our laurels in that area. We are constantly reviewing those and discussing how we can improve them and make the game safer.
Okay, that might be true that you're on the cutting edge and doing things to try to make the game safer, but simultaneously, we are seeing this reduction in a number of new players, people who are parents who are pulling their kids out of football. It's a growing trend. And so there is this notion out there that this game is dangerous and that maybe you're not doing enough to protect these kids. So what are you going to do in order to change that narrative?
Well, I think what we're doing is being successful, and we're going to need to continue to do that and find ways to do it even better. Football or any other sport is, again, not without risk. But today the game is as safe or safer than it has ever been. Equipment is better. Education is better. Awareness is better. Training practices are better. All of those things are what we're trying to, we have improved and trying to continue to improve. I think it's also important for people to understand the real science. Again, Dr. Cullum mentioned earlier, and I've referenced it once, falling off a bicycle creates more concussions than playing football. So anytime we have discussions like this, the focus is on football. Yet we had a caller ask about the safety in soccer. So all of these sports are important. So we will continue to focus on those areas, making the game safe, having the playing rules as safe as we can, having the training and practice rules as safe as we can, making sure coaches are educated and aware of head injuries as much as we can.
Okay. I got to take one more break, and we will continue the conversation talking about head injury, brain injury, concussions, and sports, youth sports. The Source continues after this quick break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about concussions and brain injuries playing youth sports. What can be done to make these sports safer and reduce risk while preserving the benefits that we get from our kids playing these organized sports? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. We got an email from Jeanette. She says, I am a pediatric nurse practitioner. She does a lot of physicals for sports, and she does baseline concussion test as a way that an athlete can able to see if they've are dealing with a concussion. Can we talk more about that, Dr. Monroe Cullum? What is a baseline concussion test?
Yes, so there are a lot of organizations offering these so-called baseline assessments. Most are computer-based tests of cognitive function. They'll do a little bit to tap aspects of attention, concentration, and working memory, and some other speed of thinking sort of things in a standardized fashion. Many schools, high schools, use these. The NFL, the NHL, many professional sports also are using baseline testing that provides some index of how an individual is doing before or prior to an injury, such as concussion. And then we do a follow-up assessment after injury, not only to look at the individual's performance relative to other similar age group and so-called test norms, but also in respect to how they did at baseline. So it's not a bad idea, and many sports do this. It's not a perfect assessment. It's not an exact science either. Various factors can go into test performance in these baseline assessments. We've got to ensure that the athlete is giving good effort. Who's monitoring the test? Who's looking at the test results? And how are those being interpreted? And what professionals are interpreting those are really important questions. So the idea is good. It also helps to get information out about concussion. It increases athletes' awareness that this is something to be taken seriously. So I think there's definitely some advantages to the baseline testing. There are some limitations, too, in terms of their absolute sensitivity. They're trying to assess a variety of aspects of cognitive functioning, but they are imperfect measures. They are one clinical tool out of a number of clinical tools. They do not diagnose concussion, but they are part of the armamentarium of assessments that healthcare professionals can use to assess symptoms following concussion.
So it's not perfect, but we're not able to look inside someone's brain and someone's head and see what the brain's doing. All we can really look at is how well the brain is performing. So, Dr. Cullum, and this is a great way in order to do that. So even before they begin the season, do they take these little, they're like computer games, right? And they remember these numbers or draw these lines and then they compare them after they took a hard hit, and they're able to see how well the brain is functioning, right?
Well, that's the idea. Although the computerized tests, again, they're imperfect measures, and they're indirect measures of brain function. And they do require, you know, careful administration and careful interpretation as well. There's a lot of these, a lot of opportunities for students to undergo these assessments at baseline all over the country now. And some sites are doing a better job than others in terms of proctoring the tests, monitoring, and reviewing the test results. Because it's essential that the baseline results reflect an individual's best effort. We sometimes will have a situation where athletes may so-called sandbag a baseline evaluation, trying to perform below their best level such that when they sustain a concussion, that then the doctors, they feel, may not fully detect them, right? So there are a whole variety of factors relating to validity and test effort that must be taken into consideration. But yes, it's become a very, very popular activity, and there are a number of major companies that are putting these sort of assessments out there.
To all schools, they're not required to do these baseline tests by the UIL, Jamie Harrison?
No, currently they are not, for many of the reasons that Dr. Cullum just mentioned. It's easy to say give a kid a baseline test, but there are any number of types of baseline tests. There is some debate over what type is better than another. There are any number of companies who are willing to offer these for a fee, of course. So there's a cost associated to school districts and or parents for conducting these. And then there's some question about just how useful they are in a sports application, because as has happened in some other leagues, there are reports of players intentionally underperforming on
right.
the pretest, so that if they sustain a hit, they can meet that same criteria.
Okay, I got that. So let me get another caller on. This is Paul Tibbetts, and he's with the National Youth Sports. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on, guys.
All right, go right ahead.
So I missed most of the show. I apologize. I meant to call in earlier. Sound like you guys are talking a little bit more into the cognitive neuroscience end of all this, but just wanted to give a little bit of my perspective. And I've been with youth sports for a while, with National Youth Sports in Phoenix, Arizona, now in San Antonio, Texas. But from my angle, the biggest thing is getting all of the coaches to buy in and understand the severity of it. We ended up canceling our tackle football program. It just felt to me that we needed to be way too hands-on to be at every single practice and to be very involved. We've partnered with Positive Coaching Alliance and NHFLS, and we require concussion certifications and things like that. But without being at every single practice and having very strict guidelines, I found it almost impossible to really feel comfortable with it. So for us, we ended up canceling tackle just because I run a bunch of other sports. If I just did tackle, I think maybe we could handle it. But with running basketball, baseball, soccer, volleyball, all these other sports, we found it was just almost too much to tackle. So,
all right, Paul. Thank you. Thank you for the call. I want to bring up a point. A Facebook brought up a comment on Facebook saying we keep comparing the problem with bicycle with football, but they say the problem with football head injuries is the repetition of head injuries, the knocking of hats, as I've heard it called frequently. So, Dr. Dan Santa Maria, is it the repetition of the hits? I mean, you could go through every play can put a knock on your head, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a real question with a lot of these professional athletes who are later diagnosed with the severe condition of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Many of them have no reported concussions, and the question there is, are they intentionally to maintain time on the field, the financial merits and rewards, and a presence with the team, being dishonest about their symptoms, or is CTE the result of multiple, what we would call subconcussive blows, banging the head, smash mouth football, or perhaps multiple jabs in boxing that just add up mileage over time?
And Dr. Cullum, can you respond to that?
Yeah, again, we actually, there's a lot we don't know about these so-called subconcussive hits. The studies that have been done out of South Carolina, North Carolina, with Kevin Guskowitz's group, have shown that measuring G-forces, for example, on the football field, the G-forces don't always correlate with concussive symptoms. One kid can get hit with a 10G hit and have concussive symptoms. The kid next to him gets hit with 70 Gs, and they're not concussed. You know, there have been some studies looking at pre- and post-season, differences in cognitive function, and we're really not seeing a lot of these cumulative effects, but it's really difficult to study in a rigorous scientific way. In terms of the former players that are recounting their histories of injuries, you know, there's so many other factors in terms of lifestyle, diet, substances and medications over the lifetime that need to be carefully evaluated when we're looking at these cumulative effects. It's very, very complicated, and it's probably not going to boil down to just how many hits have you had.
Jamie Harrison at the UIL, the data that's being collected, what data are you trying to get? Just the number of concussions that are happening in youth sports, or are we trying to figure out when these concussions are most likely to happen and how we can intervene in those moments?
Well, I think generally I would say what we're hoping to accomplish is getting the necessary research to help us keep kids safer. In terms of addressing your question specifically, I believe Dr. Cullum would be most appropriate to answer, because again, UIL itself is not conducting this research. The Brain Institute there at UT Southwestern is, and that is by design. So, Dr. Cullum?
Well, I want to go back to you, though. You're providing the leadership. You are the governing body for sports and for most kids in Texas. And everyone is looking to the UIL to come up with a way to make football, keep football, football, but maybe less brain injury involved.
Well, I agree, and that's why we're entering into agreements and collaborations with people like UT Southwestern. Look, UIL is not a medical research organization. We've never claimed to be. That's not who we are. And so if we start trying to conduct that kind of research, we would be fish out of water. We need the brain injury experts to conduct that research for us.
And you're willing to take that information and run with the ball?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. What this research will do is provide information to and help advise the UIL Medical Advisory Committee on making recommendations for policy changes to help keep kids safe. That's the whole purpose of what we're doing. Is we're not trying to be experts in an area in which we simply aren't experts. We have engaged in collaboration with those experts, and whatever the outcomes of those of this research is or what those outcomes are, we're in no way going to change or alter what's reported out from this research.
All
that
right.
Is truly up to the medical researchers.
Jamie Harrison is the Deputy Director of the University Interscholastic League. Dr. Dan Santamaria is with us, a physician at Sports Medicine San Antonio, and Dr. Monroe Cullum. He oversees the Texas Sports Concussion Registry. He is a neuropsychologist at the O'Donnell Brain Institute at UT Southwestern. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.